Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome to Luke's Massive Storytelling Podcast Thing. Whoa, yeah. Here we go. Check it out now. Enjoy.
Hello and welcome to Luke's Massive Storytelling Podcast Thing. My name is Luke and this is my thing. I just got a lovely email this morning from Neil Porter, who had some very lovely things to say about the show. Thanks, Neil. I just checked out his Instagram page, actually. And Neil does these amazing hand-lettered typographic images, all with like real pens and real paper, and it looks amazing. Definitely go check that out. His Instagram username is Neil Tony Porter. Would love to see the podcast logo done in that style, actually. I might ask you about that. But anyway, today's episode is an interview episode. It's all about indie publishing or self-publishing, the craft of writing, and independent storytelling. So won't keep you for too much longer. Enjoy the interview, and see you on the other side. All right, bye.
Garrett Robinson is most well known as the indie author behind the Nightblade epic book series. He self-published his first book in 2012 and swiftly followed it with a stream of others, publishing more than 2 million words by 2014. Within months, he topped numerous bestseller lists. Now he spends his time writing books and directing films. He lives in LA with his wife, Megan, children, Dawn, Luke, and Desmond, and his dog, Chewbacca. How does that sound?
Pretty fantastic. I see you've read my author bio.
Yeah. Yeah. I was going to use your Twitter one, but it was a lot shorter. So I thought
I'd use it. It's probably horribly out of date. I'm rarely on Twitter.
Yeah. So it says you're a filmmaker. That's how you got started, right?
Yeah. I started filmmaking way back in 2009. I mean, I'd been doing things before that, but that's when I really gave it a go. And I was doing it full time as a freelancer for 2 years. And then, well, if you think writing is a hard industry to get into, filmmaking is that times 10.
Yeah. What sort of in what capacity were you working as a freelance filmmaker, like directing or running, or what were you doing there?
Well, that's the thing, is that I wanted to direct. I love directing. It's my favorite thing in the world. And nobody wants you to direct their film unless you've already directed a whole bunch of other films, hopefully, which have either earned a lot of awards or have earned a lot of money. So I would edit people's films, and I would work on set as a script supervisor or an on-set assistant director. And it was basically impossible to graduate from that to, you know, being the head cheese. I had a bunch of scripts and story ideas, but nobody really wanted to make them. So that's when I got the idea of turning them into books. And it seems to have worked, because since I started writing, I've actually directed up to this point, I think a dozen films. And they're all, you know, short films, but they were all paid for by other people who were interested. So, you know.
Cool. Well, so did they find you through your books?
Sometimes yes, sometimes no. More often in the beginning, especially, I would take the money that I made from selling books, you know, which wasn't very much in the beginning, and I would just turn it around and fund a low budget film by myself. And I did that a couple of times. And once I had made a few projects, then other people started wanting me to do their projects. And then they started footing the bill. And consequently, the bills got a lot bigger because, you know, the people who invest in films are usually people who have a little bit more at their disposal than the people who work on them.
Yeah. And so are you looking to do your first feature length, or how far are you along that sort of path?
Yeah. I have been working on getting a feature done, it's kind of hard to say. I mean, there's a saying in the industry that it's all BS until money's in the bank.
Yeah,
and then it's all BS until cameras are rolling. And then it's all BS until the film is on the screen and, you know, being actually played for people. So there's three levels of BS you have to work through before you can actually do it. So I have been working on a feature. It's actually, I've got two that sort of have feelers out. One's a little bit further along than the other, and they're actually both based on my books. So that's kind of cool.
Okay, cool. Which books are these?
Touch is the one that's more that's a little bit further along, simply because Touch is a much simpler story. It would require a lot less resources, crew, all that sort of thing. And then the other one is Rebel Yell. Is difficult just because it's bigger, and also it requires like some licensing for music and all that sort of thing. But I do have somebody looking into, you know, whether we could get both of those things together.
So something. I mean, you're out and out an indie storyteller. Do you know what I mean? Like,
yes.
you label yourself as such. And I really appreciate that sort of side of it. If you do get feature-length film sort of funded and all the way to the screen, would you release it independently? Or how would you look to do that side of it?
Well, that sort of depends. I'm a big fan of indie filmmaking. And my favorite indie filmmaking is... from beginning to end, completely indie. But I also recognize that there's a lot of value. What a lot of people will do is they'll make a film independently with their own budget, their own creative control and everything, and then they'll sell it to the studios for distribution. And a lot of people don't even realize that that happens, but it happens all the time. Not for, you know, your Marvel movies or whatever, but... Probably the most famous case, especially since it got them into the Guinness Book of World Records, is Paranormal Activity, right?
Okay,
you know that movie?
Yeah.
So they produced that themselves for $15,000, which is just the most ridiculously tiny movie budget you can imagine. Like, you know, that's some money to some people, but it's nothing in terms of making a film. And then they got the right people to look at it, and it got picked up and distributed by a studio, and it made $65 million or something like that.
Yeah.
So it's the most profitable film ever made. It's actually in the book of records for that. So that sort of thing, that's a totally viable path. I don't want to have, you know, studio influence or whatever from the beginning of the project trying to steer it. I want to make my own thing. And if somebody else wants to, you know, pick up the tab and distribute it, then I'm fine with that.
Cool. And if that doesn't happen, you could always go, you know, VHX or Vimeo on demand or something like that, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. There's lots of, you know, YouTube has a paid option now. There's lots of people out there, you know, Netflix is, if you've already made a project, it's much easier to actually get Netflix to distribute it. And, you know, a lot of people are doing that nowadays.
Yeah. I've noticed Netflix, in the UK, we have a slightly different catalog to the US, I think. But there's a lot of like YouTube web series and stuff that like Video Game High School they've ended up on there. So you never really know. I mean, you could just distribute. I mean, I've just finished reading Rebel Without a Crew. You know, the Robert Rodriguez book.
Yeah, yeah.
Have you read that at all?
No, I haven't. People keep telling me I need to, but my reading time is limited. Less so now. I'll put it on my reading list because now I'm able to actually get myself a little bit of time each day.
It's a little bit out of date in the sense of it's all about 35mm film and whatnot, but the general ethos behind it is to just make the film and then, you know, get it distributed afterwards.
Yeah,
but yeah, man, it sounds good. So and Touch.
Yeah, I think that's what like filmmakers who really like love the art. It's like just get something made. You know, none of the short films that I've ever, you know, short films don't like turn a profit. They don't generate huge revenue.
No.
But you love it, man. You really, really love it. And it should be the same thing, I think, no matter what you're doing, whether you're making movies or you're writing books.
So what short film of yours would you want people to watch? What's your calling card short?
Oh, geez. I would love for people to watch Unsaid, which was the film that we shot it last year, and it released, I think, February of this year. But I, as I've often said, Unsaid is unfortunately like the least commercial piece ever. It's about a guy whose mother is passing away from a severe illness.
So it's like comedy, right?
Exactly. Okay, yeah. Like people are just, you know, people who have gone through something like that, they really, really like it. But it's not the sort of thing you get your friends all together and be like, hey, let's watch this Friday night. And then, you know, go quietly cry in the corner.
Cool. And that's the one that's linked on your website, right?
Yes, correct.
Okay. So Unsaid. I'll link that in the show notes as well so people can check that out.
But awesome.
So tell me, because I think I came across you, stumbled upon you, probably through Sean and Johnny and those guys.
I've never heard that before. That's pretty.
But then, instantly sort of fell in love with the website, the sort of ethos behind what you're doing. Like it, like a lot of indie publishing, I have to say, it does have like a certain stinkiness to it. But everything seems on your website, especially, seems to have a sheen of professionalism to it.
Oh, thanks very much. Yeah, I mean, indie publishing is like any indie art form, whether it's YouTube. You know, there's a lot of amazing YouTube channels. And I think because YouTube is more of a thing and more sort of in the cultural zeitgeist, people think of YouTube as like, oh, no, there's a lot of really good YouTube channels out there. And the first thing they think about YouTube isn't the number of terrible, awful, awful videos and channels there are on YouTube. They think, oh, I've seen a lot of things on YouTube that I like. And for some reason, self-publishing is still going through this period where the first thing people think is, oh, this is a bunch of slush pile stuff. And they don't necessarily have the name recognition of, you know, the people who are doing really good things on it. So I try to be one of the good people and not one of the slush piles.
Yeah, I think you sort of have to start with like professionalism and like from the cover and the ground up and everything. Otherwise, it's very easy to get lumped in with. I mean, there is a lot of good self-published stuff out there, but there's also a lot of crap as well.
Yes,
and I think you definitely with your stuff you've separated yourself, which is ideal.
I do my best. Thanks.
So, tell us how you got into writing books.
Well. Okay, so I was doing the filmmaking thing, and I had a friend, a guy named Zach Bolger, who writes under the name ZC Bolger, and he has always wanted to be a writer, and he was working on his first kid's book called Danny Calloway and the Puzzle House, which is a great book, by the way. Sure. I say that as the editor. So he had struck upon the idea of self-publishing because he was, you know, pursuing the traditional deal and the publishing house and all that. And then he found the self-publishing podcast after he started researching self-publishing. And he told me, you got to listen to these guys because I think that you could take your scripts and you could publish them as books. And I was very, no, I mean, come on, that's ridiculous. But I promised I would start listening to the podcast. So I listened to everything that they'd recorded up to that point. And I think they'd just finished their first year when I started.
Yeah.
And almost immediately I was like, holy crap, I could actually do this. So I wrote the film that I had like in its most complete state. I turned that into a book first, and that was Touch. Which is probably going to be retitled. It's Touch currently.
Cool. That's
fine. And that was more successful than I thought it would be, and it started making a little money, and then I wrote you know the next book and the next, and 5 months after that, I think it was five months after I published my first book, I actually lost my 9-to-5 job that I was working at that time, and when I came home completely devastated.
So you didn't quit. You got fired.
No.
So,
yeah. I got not fired. People always tell me, I'm always like, yeah, I got fired. And they're like, no, fired is when it's like you screwed up and whatever. But basically the company just downsized and I was one of the ones. So people are always like, no, you got to say you got let go.
You were jettisoned.
I was working there and then I was suddenly not. Like that's cool. All there is to it.
So in terms of your financial status at the time, was that like a big impact? Were you like, oh crap, I need to?
Oh god, yeah. I wasn't anywhere close to earning what, you know, a full-time living off of writing at that point. Which was the first thing on my mind. But when I came home completely devastated, you know, I told my wife what had happened, and she was like, you know, I bet if you went full time, you could make the writing thing work, which is just not what you expect your wife to say when you come home and tell her that you got laid off. Yeah. But I did. And so I started, I was doing a lot of freelance work right off the bat. And a lot of it was for Sean and Johnny, who I had already been, you know, working with on things for some time. But they basically gave me a lot of work, a lot of referrals, and that kept me going long enough until, you know, writing became more of a thing. And now it's my full-time thing. Now I don't need to do anything other than just write, which is a pretty nice place to be.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. So which book was it where you realized, oh, this could actually work?
I had a hope that things could actually work off the first book. Cause like I said, I was expecting the whole thing of like putting out Touch and then, you know, my parents would buy it and that would be about it. Mm. But it was more than that. So I was hopeful from that point. When I put out the Realm Keeper series, which incidentally was co-written with ZC Bolger, the guy who got me to start doing it in the first place, that was the first time where I saw an audience reaction that I was like, whoa, this is actually a thing. It wasn't quite where it needed to be in order to, you know, make it a full-time thing, but it was really close. And then Nightblade was the tipping point. And particularly the third book in the Nightblade series was really what pushed it over the edge, as well as, you know, all of the marketing things that I'd learned from working with Johnny and Sean for years. Just applying that was kind of like flipping a switch where suddenly everything was all pink and rosy and rainbows and unicorns and stuff.
So a lot of people getting into writing books and self-publishing are probably going to think it's only going to take them two or three books, or the first book's going to take off and that's going to be them sorted for the next few years. Obviously that's not true.
No, like to those people I would say, you know, good pluck, you got gumption, and I like that, but you are wrong. That is not what's going to happen at all.
So what was the difference between the one that did break out, the Nightblade book, and the ones before?
Yeah, that's an interesting thing, and I've been thinking about it a lot recently. Actually, there is this adage and this sort of advice that, you know, the best marketing for your first book is your second book, and the best marketing for your second book is your third book. Like, just keep writing, keep putting material out. That is very, very true. And for 2.5 years, that was my total operating basis. You know, liked it too, because, you know, I did have to pull in a lot of freelance stuff to actually make sure I was, you know, doing what I needed to financially for my family. But really the turning point, like what I didn't realize is that once you do have the catalog, like you have to get the catalog there, but once you do have a backlist or a series with a good number of books in the series, that's when your game plan switches from, oh, write the next book to start marketing what you've got. And okay, that was the difference. Was I started doing, you know, I started doing Facebook ads taught by Mark Dawson and Nick Stevenson's course. And of course, all of the stuff that I learned from the self-publishing podcast. And what I had been ignoring those things because I didn't have a catalog. And then this year it was like, okay, let's start actually doing some real marketing. And I did that, and then also got a book club ad. And that was what really made the difference for me.
So in terms of the nitty gritty of the marketing, so the book club ad, I mean, I know that's pretty difficult to get nowadays. So if someone just starting out, what would you say to them to do? Just start writing, building up the catalog, or?
Yeah, just starting out, definitely your first priority is building up the catalog, because a BookBub ad is hard to get. But if you're submitting one book for a BookBub ad, that's really hard to get. If you're submitting 8 different books for a BookBub ad, you've just automatically increased your odds 8 times. And then, of course, anything that you can do to make your book look more attractive, the more reviews you have, the more the higher your sales rank, anything that you can do to boost that is awesome. But BookBub is always going to be... BookBub is never going to be more than a really good month. It's not going to be the foundation for what you're doing. It's going to be a really excellent boost that if you handle it well, will raise your overall level of sales and response and marketing effectiveness. But it's never going to be your be-all, end-all strategy. For anybody just starting out, honestly, and I feel so bad saying this, but just starting out right now, this could change, you know, next month, next week, or tomorrow. But right now, going KDP Select is probably a good option for new authors. It gives you a lot of tools to help sell your book better, and you can always leave KDP Select later, you know. But I made the decision on Nightblade a few months ago to go Select, Amazon exclusive, and I hate being exclusive, but it was difficult to gain traction on any other platform. And just by switching to Select, I was immediately just completely justifying the cost. Now, the thing that sucks about that is that you're exclusive. Your audience is, you know, by default limited, but you can always expand onto the other platforms again. It's just a really good place to start out. So for anybody who is just beginning their career, just writing and getting ready to self-publish their first book, I would recommend it right now. Again, that could completely change at any time. But that just speaks to a broader point, which is that you have to pay constant attention to what's happening in the industry, what's working for people and what's not.
And how would people stay in touch with what's going on?
Well, I mean, there's, you know, numerous podcasts, Johnny and Sean, yeah. Self-publishing podcast, obviously, and Joanna Penn's The Creative Pen podcast. Those podcasts are awesome for this kind of thing because they're weekly and they're always updating on stuff like that. And maybe the latest changes aren't the focus of their podcast, but they'll always talk about it. David Gogren's blog is also good. He used to update a lot more than he does currently, but I think he's going to be picking back up again pretty shortly. I know he just had a big book release. He has like invaluable data. And then there's things like the Kindle boards, which a lot of people keep up on the latest and greatest on the Kindle boards. I don't visit the Kindle boards, but if for somebody who prefers more of like an online forum type environment, that's a really good place to be.
When I found the Kindle boards, I spent so much time on there. It was a bit of a time suck. I found myself doing that rather than doing the stuff that I should actually be doing, like editing words and whatnot.
Yeah.
Whereas podcasts, you can do that when you're washing the pots or just going for a walk or whatever.
Yeah.
So you had some success, and then the Rebel Yell happened. So, which is like a literary novel, right?
Yeah. Rebel Yell is my favorite book that never sells. Ever. Okay. Which is kind of unfortunate, but it is literary. I knew that was going to happen.
What made you sit down and sort of write it? What sort of gave you the impetus to start with that?
Well, Rebel Yell is about an indie band where the lead singer is this brilliant singer-songwriter, and everybody in the band is very good, but the lead singer, Steve, he wants traditional. He wants the record label and the deal and the paid for tour and all that sort of thing. And his lead guitarist, Tanya, is like, let's basically self-publish, right? So I had 3 years, 2 years of experience in an industry where indies were kind of, you know, put down all the time. And like you said, had the stink. And traditional was held as this great and wonderful bastion of artistic quality and integrity. But it was the same industry that was putting out, you know, Snooki's autobiography, and just recently came out with Twilight Reimagined, which is just
Right.
Something I'm not a big fan of. Let's just leave it at that.
Okay.
And I, so Rebel Yell is actually a very thinly veiled criticism of traditional media versus indie art in general. And I really wanted to write that book. And I also wanted to write something that I could hold up in people's faces if they said, well, you write genre, you know, it's like, it's easy to write a fantasy story. You just have somebody cast a fireball every few pages and everything's good.
And this doesn't happen in Rebel Yell.
No, very few fireballs in Rebel Yell.
Okay,
I had to
cool.
cut my, I toned myself way down on the fireballs.
Yeah.
So that was also important to me, was like, can I just write, you know, because I'm a big fan of a lot of literary authors, like, you know, John Green is the one who I read everything of his and love his work. And he doesn't require any genre conventions to tell an incredibly compelling story. So I wanted to give it a shot and see if I could do it, too. And I think I did OK. And people like it. So there you go. But they don't buy it.
Well, I mean. It's going to be there available forever, essentially, I'm guessing, right?
So
it could always find an audience later on down the line. I mean, you never really know this sort of thing. It's
totally.
Weird to me that, like, one of my favorite authors, Haruki Murakami, his most famous book is Norwegian Wood, which is the only book that isn't, like, a Murakami novel. I don't really know how people found that above the others. Maybe it's the whole traditional publishing thing. I don't know. So what are you working on next? What's going to be coming out in the future with the books?
Well, the most important thing for me right now is to complete books 4, 5, and 6 in the Nightblade series.
And there's going to be 9 in total, right?
No, there's going to be basically until I feel like the series is done. I'm moving towards making the books a little bit more self-sufficient so that you could, like, the first trilogy is very necessary, but later books, including 4, I want anybody to be able to pick them up and enjoy them without having read everything that came before, because there's lots of series that I read that are like that, and I quite enjoy them. So basically you could think of it as like the Jack Reacher of fantasy, where the books aren't even written in chronological order and you can pick any one of them up and just really, really like it. So 4, 5, and 6 are my top priority. But also I want to get those done fast and, you know, so that they're ready to release every few months. And then I want to start a pet project that I've had in mind for quite some time. A sci-fi, space opera, that's just been kicking around in my head and sort of satisfies a very Doctor Who like obsession that I have, because I freaking love that show. And it's not a Doctor Who book, but it's sort of along those lines and just sort of something that I've wanted to do for a while. And I figured if I could get far enough ahead on you know, Nightblade, then I can actually take the time and do it.
Does this new book have any sort of London references? Because if you ever need any help with that, I can take some pictures.
It does not.
Oh, okay.
It could. It could, though. Maybe. I want it to have. I mean, I grew up on, you know, Monty Python and Blackadder and you know, English comedies and obviously Doctor Who is not like that at all. But it. I hadn't watched any programs like that in a really long time. And so when somebody turned me on to Doctor Who, and then later, a year after I started watching Doctor Who, and I was still catching up, somebody turned me on to Sherlock. There's this flavor to those shows that I didn't realize I was missing until I started watching it again. And I was like, oh my God, it's something so entirely different.
Is this the Cumberbatch Sherlock?
Yes.
It is really good. He is, for me, the best Sherlock I think I've ever seen. It's
yeah.
Like fantastic.
He's really incredible. I don't like to compare people who play the same role because as a filmmaker, like I know that everybody who goes in is really trying to do their own thing. And so I always see them as like I never try and judge who the best Bond is, you know, because everybody's trying to do their own thing. Of course, there are some Bonds that are just objectively terrible, but not speaking to that. Yeah, so that's sort of the impetus behind the space opera. But it's like Earth is a distant memory. It's not it has no place on Earth whatsoever.
Okay, cool. So London isn't in it.
No.
Okay.
No,
so that's okay. But so you published more than 2 million words by within 2 years, I guess. Does that sound about right? So maybe, could you take us like into a bit of detail on what your publishing and your writing process is like? Like, how long does it take to plan out a novel? Do you plan? Do you plot? Or do you just sort of pants it and sit down and write? How does that work?
No, I'm a rabid plotter. I tried pantsing a novel once. I got three chapters in, and I was just like, oh my God, what is even happening? Like, I was so confused. And I never self-edit while I'm working, but just because I knew it wasn't working, I went back and I read what I'd already written, and I was like, I'm gonna have to, like, none of this is gonna survive. This is all terrible. It's all crap. So I'm a very big plotter. Some would say that I plot in too much detail, but I plot as much as I feel like I need to.
Yeah.
And I sit down, I start very, very big, and I describe basically my entire book in a single sentence, and then I break it down into a paragraph, and then four paragraphs, and then a few pages, and then by that point I'm usually ready to sit down and write the whole book out in scene by scene descriptions, like, okay, in this scene blah happens, in this scene blah happens. And then I used to try and structure it into chapters at that point, but now I actually just write scene by scene, and then I decide when I'm actually putting the book together where the chapters break and where they don't. So
okay, so and how long does that process normally take, or does that change with every book?
It actually mostly depends on the length of the book. So Nightblade is a fantasy series, but it's not as hefty as people generally associate with fantasy. You know, each of the Wheel of Time books, for example, is about 250,000 words long. And my Realmkeeper series, the first two books, each one is about 250,000 words long. Nightblade is 100,000 words long. So it's about half the time that it takes me to do the Realmkeeper's books. But I actually have been tracking my time that I've been working on each of the Nightblade books, and it's about 90 hours from beginning to end. But that sounds like,
that's,
oh well, if you work a 40-hour week, you could do it in 2 weeks. Well, I can't write for 8 hours a day. I just can't. Like, maybe this is a great failing of mine, but like, holy cow, my brain just turns off very quickly. So so it usually takes me, I'll say in the past it has taken me about a month, about 2 months of dedicated time. But now I have somebody else doing my covers. I have somebody else editing my books. So basically I can get a Nightblade book done in under a month.
Okay. So, and when you're sitting down to, so you've got your outline all planned out, you sit down and you think, right, I'm going to start writing now. How many sort of words are you doing per session, and like how long are you sitting down for?
Well, some people have a problem sharing how much they produce, how fast they write. I don't, because I found it very inspiring to hear what other people were doing, but I do realize why people don't like sharing that data. So I always like to add a caveat, which is like, you should not compare yourself to anybody else's production level in terms of your success or failure. If you hear a number that sounds really, really high to you, then just realize that you are a different person than the person that you're hearing about, right? Yeah. So, I mean, George R. R. Martin is probably the best paid writer alive today, and he only writes 500 words a day. So it's like, you're fine. Whatever you can do, as long as you do it consistently and reliably is fine. I will generally write 2,500 words an hour. If I'm really on a roll, I can hit 4,000. But that's pretty few and far between.
Yeah. So I think the way I got into your YouTube vlog was
through one of your videos when you had a particularly high number of words. How many words was it again?
That was 50,000 words in 3 days.
Yeah, I mean, that is ludicrous. Like,
that was a good week. Yeah.
So how did that work? How did you write 50,000 words in 3 days?
I was really on a roll, and I had instituted a policy which I have slipped from since then, and I need to get back in now that I'm beginning work on the fourth book, or continuing work on the fourth book, I should say.
Yeah.
Which is that I wake up in the morning, I'm not allowed to look at my phone, my iPad, or anything on the internet until I've done my writing for the day. And when my brain is exhausted and I can no longer put words down, then I'm allowed to check my email. Like, I can't check my email. I'm not allowed to look at Twitter. Like, I don't look at anything online until I'm done with my, you know, writing for the day.
That's incredibly difficult. How did you?
Oh my God. It's so hard. Which is why I slipped out of that routine. And every time I slip out of that routine, my writing suffers. So, one goal that I have before the end of the year is hiring an assistant, which I can, you know, finally do now. And their primary job is going to be keeping me away. Like, you heard that story of the guy who hired an assistant, and they would have the assistant sit with them at Starbucks while they were writing.
Yeah.
And every time the writer went to Facebook, the assistant's job was to slap him in the face.
It's not Ramit Sethi, it's his brother.
Yeah, so I don't want to go that far, but I need somebody to do that for me, to keep me off it. Because it's not an invalid desire to wake up and want to check your email. You know, have I received any important emails, anything I need to take care of right away? But if you can have somebody handling that for you, or at least just making sure that nothing's on fire, then I know that my writing would be quite productive. One day during that 3 day period where I wrote 50,000 words, on one of those days, I wrote 27,000 words in a day. Like, that was a really good day, you know?
Yeah.
So there's no reason that I will not be able to write 27,000 words a day every day, but there's no reason that I couldn't be doing a lot more than I am now. I calculated my potential based off of that. Mm. And at like my full potential, at the time I had published 1.5 million words, but I could have published 15 million words. So there's, you know, maybe that's a little bit pie in the sky to do that much in 3 years, but I could be doing better than I am now. And that's the other thing to remember, is that you can always improve. And if you're not working and trying to improve, then chances are you're going to get worse. There's no one word for that, is there?
Well, I always think of the shark that stops swimming. It dies, right?
Yeah, exactly. you got to be a shark.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So this assistant you're going to hire to slap you in the face, are they going to have access to your emails or something, or how is that going to work?
Yeah, I want them to I want them to basically manage pretty much my entire online presence, including running my vlog and novel channel, because as dumb as this sounds, sometimes the reasons that I don't do any writing in a whole day is because I just can't be buggered to... Oh, sorry.
It's fine. We say buggered all the time over here. It's fine.
Fantastic. I just can't... I can't bother setting up the live stream. So, you know, in my perfect world, my little dream world, I wake up, I have my coffee, I walk into my office, and the stream is ready to go. I sit down, I push the button, and I start writing. You know, like, that would be the thing that they would do. They would check my emails, they'd delete the mountain of spam that I get every day, and then they'd forward, you know, any important emails onto me so that I could actually answer them. They'd check online, make sure that, you know, if anybody asked me a question on Twitter or Facebook or whatever, I like to answer people as quickly as I can. So if I get a question, then they, you know, they just forward it on to me. But honestly, there's no other reason for me to be on Facebook other than to receive communication from people. Like, I definitely don't get a lot of quality content, valuable content on Facebook. I have a long history of kind of despising Facebook, even though it's a place where a lot of people like to hang out. And, you know, I don't want to say unfortunately, but unfortunately, a lot of my readers are on Facebook. So I kind of have to be there, but I don't enjoy it as a user at all. Even though every time I go there, I end up spending a lot more time than I want to, because it's designed to be addictive and to make you spend time on the website. You know, that's how they work. So I would much rather have somebody handling my Facebook presence for me.
So just out of personal curiosity, I guess, what would your ideal day look like, your ideal working day?
Yeah, so ideal day, I get up, I have my coffee. Which I'll make myself. I don't need an assistant to make my coffee.
Okay.
I like that ritual as well.
Yeah.
Have my coffee. I walk in. My live stream for Vlog Novel is ready to go. You probably know Vlog Novel, right? I live stream all of my writing. Okay. Yeah. So I stream Vlog Novel for an hour, take a break, come back, stream it for another hour. And probably after 3, 4, maybe 5 hours of Vlog Novel, I'm done with my writing for the day. At that point, I would make my YouTube video for the day, which is usually the process of about an hour. If I had an assistant, it would be the process of about 15 to 20 minutes, because then I'd just have to sit, write the script, and record it, and then they would edit it. And then I would handle whatever other, you know, business type stuff that I had to do, check on my advertisements and handle any emails that my assistant would have forwarded to me and all that sort of thing. There's a lot of administration that goes into it. You are your own business, your own publisher when you're doing this.
Yeah.
So yeah, that would be a fantastic day. Actually, I got to live that day for a very brief period of time earlier this year before I hit my big milestone this year. We basically tried to hit that milestone. My wife used to run a daycare. She closed the daycare and was my assistant for four weeks. Mm. And holy cow, that was like the best time of my life. You know, she got to take care of so much stuff that I didn't need to take care of anymore. And I was super productive and I was writing all the time. And I didn't even have to pay her. It was fantastic. So, yeah. So that was really like my ideal day. And I just want to get back to that.
Cool.
Basically.
So I'll let people know you need an assistant. Are you advertising or?
No, I actually have somebody in mind. It's either going to be, it's probably not going to be my wife again, because she's now, you know, doing things that she really enjoys. But I do have somebody in mind. We're actually already in talks and trying to work out how it would all work.
Cool. Okay. So, so you mentioned briefly, we haven't really talked about the vlogging side of it, but that sounds like quite a big side of you, and yeah, your sort of endeavors. What, so vlogging, in all honesty, I know sort of very little about, but I watch Good Mythical Morning sometimes and your vlog, and I think that's pretty much it. So tell us a bit about the vlog and the topics you discuss.
Well, I had I started a YouTube channel for my own podcast, because my business plan has always been do whatever, you know, Johnny and Sean are doing. So so I had my own podcast for a while, and then every once in a while I would just make a video about something because I had attention on it. Sometimes it was a tutorial video teaching somebody how to do something technical, like publish a book to Kindle or whatever. And sometimes it was a video about my opinions on something. So I was actually guesting on Buddy Gott's podcast. Mm. I forget what he calls it, but I've always just thought of it as Buddy Gott's podcast. And he was like, you know, I really love those videos you used to do all the time. You should consider doing something like that again. And it was a few days before January 1st, 2014. So I was like, okay, I'm New Year's resolution. I'm going to have an actual YouTube channel. So I started a YouTube channel and I started making videos every day. God, they were so bad. They were so bad. I went back. I watched one just yesterday because it related to something that another YouTuber that I liked had made a video about. And I went back and I watched it. I think it was my 10th video since I started making YouTube videos every day. And God, it was terrible. But I could still see what I liked about my videos in it, right?
Yeah.
So I started making that every day. And after after a few weeks, maybe a month and a half, a friend, an old high school friend who I was connected to on Shutter, Facebook, messaged me and was like, "You really remind me of the Vlogbrothers, John and Hank Green." And I was like, "Who are you talking about? I don't know who these people are." So he told me I had to watch them, and I went and I started watching their videos, and oh my God, they were doing exactly what I wanted to do on YouTube, except I didn't know that I wanted to do it until I'd seen them doing it.
Yeah.
So that's when I considered myself to get like really into YouTube, which means honestly, I'm really late on the bandwagon. You know, it came out in 2007, and John and Hank Green, the Vlogbrothers, have been doing it full time since 2007. So I was 7 years late to the party. But in fact, I got so involved in it and so into it that I went to Hank Green's YouTube convention that year, and I went again this year. And yeah, so I have a going concern of a YouTube channel, and then my secondary channel, Vlog a Novel, which is much more of like it's a very niche audience. But basically, I just make videos. I try to make them every day, but I'm usually not able to. It's usually more like three or four a week, and they're just about pretty much whatever I want. I talk fantasy and sci-fi a lot because that's what I love. But then sometimes I'll talk about, you know, social issues and whatever. I really like it.
So it's not like you're not doing this for like a marketing for your books and films, right? It's like it's another creative endeavor rather than a marketing act itself.
Yeah, I mean, I'd be lying if I said there wasn't a lot of cross promotion there. And I strongly encourage my readers to go follow me there because I like talking to them. You know, it's the thing that I always say about marketing is that if it feels skeezy, you're doing it wrong. So like, yes, the YouTube channel is marketing for my books. A lot of people find my books after they find my YouTube channel, but I do it because I like it. It's a very close connection with my readers. It's this balance. Writing a book, even writing one pretty fast, and people would say that I write books pretty fast, it's still a long endeavor. You're still talking about a couple of months from idea to completion, and it's out there, and probably longer after that until you start getting reviews and all that sort of thing. YouTube is so immediate. It's a nice balance. You make a video and that day you're getting views and comments and hearing from people. You're getting immediate gratification on feedback of something that you're doing. So that's something that I really love about it. And this is kind of annoying, but like a lot of people will come to my YouTube channel and tell me what they thought about my last book. And I'm like, thank you so much. Could you please go leave that in a review on Amazon? And they rarely do.
Yeah.
But I really do enjoy it. And I have made a lot of friends who I would consider close personal friends just on YouTube, where the, you know, they haven't read my books and don't know me anywhere other than my YouTube channel.
People who do find your vlog and sort of start watching your videos and everything, they could well stumble onto your books from there, though, right?
Oh yeah, happens all the time. I get that a lot. You know, because to me, my YouTube channel is a lot like an email list. You know, I let them know when I put out a new book. So a good portion of my videos are about my books. So, yeah.
So just one more question then, really. Who are your favorite storytellers and what are your favorite stories?
Oh, boy. Okay, well, yeah, I want to preface by saying that I'm very conscious of the difference between favorite and best.
Okay.
Like I recognize that, you know, Citizen Kane is one of the best films of all time, but if me and a bunch of friends are going to sit down and watch a movie on a Saturday night, I'm not likely to suggest Citizen Kane. It's an incredible piece of filmmaking that I value tremendously, but it's not my favorite, right? So I just want to preface that because people are always like, that's not the best. The technical quality of this is so much better. And I'm like, yeah, okay, but that's not my favorite.
Yeah.
So my favorite book is Lord of the Rings. And I am fully aware of the fact that, you know, how much has come since then in fantasy and everything. But to me, that's just, I read that book once a year. I read it earlier this year. I'm going to read it again early next year. It's just incredible.
Is that including The Hobbit as well, or do you skip past that one?
No, I mean, I like The Hobbit. I enjoy it, and I read it as part of the the yearly ritual. But yeah. It's not same level to me at all.
Yeah.
Lord of the Rings is just a cut above, and so that's my favorite. Another favorite storyteller of mine, although a very problematic one, is Orson Scott Card, because Ender's Game will always be one of my favorite books, period. Unfortunately, Orson Scott Card is a bit of, I believe you have a term, wanker.
That's something some of us say, not all of us.
Yes, yeah. Yes. He is one of those in his personal life, which is really, really weird. I wonder if he's not just trolling, because his books are so different from his espoused worldview and his own personal political agenda. It's quite bizarre. But Ender's Game is simply one of the best science fiction books of all time. Like, nothing will ever change that. I adore that whole series, although most people think it went downhill.
And in terms of the films based off those books, are you happy with them?
I think that Lord of the Rings, again, Lord of the Rings is my favorite film of all time. I can, as a whole, I got into filmmaking because of the Lord of the Rings, and it's still like my gold standard in terms of creating an amazing story visually. As if you take the scale, the epic quality of my love for Lord of the Rings, and you turn it into a photographic negative, that's how I feel about Ender's Game. I was so upset by that film that I actually, oh boy, it's I'm likely to have some sort of physical fit if I talk about it too much, but I really despise that that movie. Yeah.
Cool. No, that's a good note to end on. But cool. So Lord of the Rings book and the Lord of the Rings film, they're the two main ones, right? And then the Ender's Game book as well. Okay, cool.
Yeah.
All right, man. So is there anywhere that my listeners can sort of follow you? I mean, there's the YouTube vlog, there's your website. What's your Twitter handle?
Garrett Author, with two T's in Garrett. Yeah, the website's good. YouTube is honestly probably the best. Mostly my YouTube, my website, my blog is just me sharing links to my videos. So YouTube is definitely the best place to keep up with what's going on.
Cool. All right, man. Thank you very much for doing this.
Absolutely.
Thanks for listening to the show. I hope you enjoyed it. We just penciled in a couple of 7-day story challenges, so look forward to those. Also, check out our story studio. Hawk and Cleaver has a new website, www.hawkandcleaver.com. There's lots of cool stuff we're going to be doing. We've got books and Kickstarter campaigns next year. But anyway, yeah, so here's one thing you can do for me. If you do enjoy the show, tweet me or email me. That's lukeofcondor@me.com or @lukeofcondor. And tell me what your favorite word is. And then on the next show, I'll tell you what mine is. That's how it works. All right? Cool. All right. See you later. Bye.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight. and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.